Thank you for that. Sorry about the confusion about the rooms. So my background is in biology and genetics, and the first thing that I noticed about coming here was the difference in cultures. That when we give talks, we always use PowerPoints, show slides full of data, often too full so that you can't see what's going on. So here I thought I would try to fit into the local culture and just give a talk using the blackboard. I think that'll be fun, and I must say that I've never done it before in my professional life. And in fact, I haven't actually seen a blackboard with chalk for as long as I can remember. But anyway, having decided that, I wondered, what should I talk about? And I didn't have any very clear, definite instructions about that, just kind of whatever might be interesting. So I thought about going back to the way Dick started, and there, so with data. Then we have a number of DNA sequences that might come from closely related species, or more likely from different members of the same species, that are different copies of the same region of the genome. And we find some some differences among those. And then what he has talked about and what Bob have talked about is really what you can do, or some of the things that you can do after you've got these sequences. But what I'll talk about instead is how we get to this stage. And there are really kind of two aspects to that, that one we can call biology, and the other technology. And it's really biology that suggests to us the questions that might be interesting, the data sets that we might want to generate. And my interest is in human evolution, so we'll be thinking about some data sets relevant to that. So for human evolution in the broad sense, if we would make a species tree with humans down here, our closest living relatives are chimpanzees, and we split from those maybe 6 or 7 million years ago. And we have a pretty good human reference sequence. We also have had for several years now a chimpanzee reference sequence. So we can do comparisons between those two species if we want. The other African great ape is the gorilla. Now that's split off maybe 8-9 million years ago, just a relatively small amount of time earlier than the chimpanzee. And at present, we don't have a reference sequence of the gorilla. So one of the projects that's going on at Sanger, and that I'll mention, is generating a reference sequence of the gorilla. and some of the questions that come up there. And then within humans, we're very interested in human diversity, the tiny amount of variation that's accumulated in this part of the tree. And so the second project that I'll talk about is the Thousand Genomes Project that's generating the largest data set on human variation that we've had so far, and that was actually mentioned in one of the earlier talks. And you'll notice that...
Can I ask a very ignorant question? A reference sequence is a single individual or consensus of something?
So in the case of the human reference sequence, then each part of it is derived from one copy of the genome, but different regions of the genome come from different individuals. Because one of the things that you have to consider quite a lot when you're dealing with human sequences are the ethical issues. And at the time when the human reference sequence was being generated, people were a little uncertain of the ethical implications of sequencing someone's DNA and then making that freely available. So the way they decided to do it was to collect DNA from many people, 20, 30 people, I think, to immediately destroy some of those so that even the donors wouldn't be sure that they had contributed, to extract DNA and make libraries from others, and then to make the reference sequence from clones coming from all of those libraries. So the human reference sequence is a real mixture, and that's actually a complication for some purposes. And I think now people have become a little bit more relaxed, and people like Craig Venter, Jim Watson have recently had their personal sequences determined, and those are available. So if one would want a reference that was a single individual, one could go to those. But there is an issue of quality, that the quality of those sequences is, in terms of completeness and accuracy, is a lot lower than the reference. In the case of the chimpanzee, it was derived from one single individual. And in the case of the gorilla, it's being derived from one single individual. So the last kind of preliminary thing that I should say is that you'll notice that these are projects that are just getting going. So I'm not going to be showing you results and conclusions from them, but rather and the way their design and setup is being thought about, and some of the issues that we have to deal with when we do that. Okay, so first, the gorilla sequence. So having decided that we want a gorilla reference sequence, then a single individual was chosen, so a gorilla called Camilla, living, I think, San Diego Zoo, somewhere near here.
Just take a step back. I know the macaque has been sequenced. Where is
yes.
that on the tree?
Mm. Okay. So that's kind of coming off here quite a long time earlier. I don't remember that. Maybe 15, 20 million years ago. I mean, these are the kind of numbers that the more closely you look at them, the more difficult they are to tie down exactly. And there's quite a lot of variation in opinion about where we should put them exactly. Although in general, the order of the branching of the species is quite well established and accepted. So to generate a reference sequence that the DNA is cloned in libraries that can be around 40 kb, typically 10 kb, 2 kb in size. It's useful to have a mixture of these sizes. And then each clone is sequenced in from both ends. And in traditional capillary sequencing, these reads are usually around 500, 700 base pairs. And then with these, one would generate some millions of reads. If I've done the sums correctly, then 5 million would be about 1 times coverage of the genome. In this case, what was generated was 2 times coverage of the genome. So these reads are taken more or less at random, except for some preferences of the cloning procedure. So from them, the task is to reassemble them into a single reference sequence. And that's something that people have been working on for many years, probably for decades. With enough good quality data, it's pretty much a solvable problem, although there are still some regions of the genome that are repeated, and these can be many kilobases, even megabases in size, and they can be repeated in an exact fashion. So apart from those, one could assemble a reference sequence in a fairly straightforward way.
How does one generate the fragment library as by restriction?
You could do it by cutting with restriction enzymes, but it's better just to break by random shearing of the DNA, because that way you get a more even coverage.
One can even get 40 kb segments by shearing and go on.
In that case, there's an extra step. There's a biological step. So when you shear, you get a very broad range of fragments. But you can package these in a lambda phage, a virus that infects E. coli, and that turns out to have a quite narrow size requirement. So you end up with maybe 35 to 40, 42 or something kb size range. In these other cases, they would just be cut from a gel.
500 to 700 base pairs, that refers to
the amount of sequence that you generate from the end of...
But you don't sequence the whole, right?
In this approach, you just sequence the ends of the clones.
Yeah, it might be worth pointing out to people who don't know that this is a paired end strategy, and the idea is that if you can anchor one end of the sequence, then you know the other end of the sequence is about 40 kb away. And so it helps you join things together. And people have done some theory on this, and this kind of mixture of sizes turns out to be better than other strategies. So actually, there's been some work on that. That's the idea of these paired reads.
Yeah.
Especially with repeated sequences and things like that. This is quite helpful.
So the middle of that long bit, and you only know the middle bit because there's some other overlapping bit for which the end.
Yes, that's right. That during the assembly process, you'll hope to find maybe a short clone that overlaps with that, and then some other clones. So this is an absolutely standard procedure that's been used many times, and if with enough coverage it works well, but two times coverage is not enough. So what you get when you assemble from this is a whole lot of small assemblies that people call contigs, and in this case I think there are some thousands of contigs. So what do you do with those if you want a more complete reference sequence? So one thing is you can just accept those, order them as well as possible using information, say, from human or chimp, and then let people use them. And a lot of genomes are presented just about in that form. That a second possibility would be to do a lot more of this, and with typically six times you get a much more complete sequence. The problem with that is that this is expensive, and we don't have for this project enough money, and we're talking about several tens of millions of dollars to go from two times to six times. So we don't have the money to extend the coverage in what would be a traditional way. So what we're in the process of doing is taking advantage of some advances in technology that have reduced the cost of sequencing by a factor of 100 to a 1,000. So that means for the price of a small amount of coverage by traditional capillary sequencing, we can generate many times genome coverage using these new technologies. But that does come at a price. So what I'll do next is tell you a little bit about these new technologies and the kind of data that they generate.
To go back to the human reference sequence, is it still sort of changing? Has it entirely stabilized, or does it still get tweaked? People discover some error.
No, there's a new release every. I mean, now it's not very often, every couple of years, and it is still improving because there are gaps, there are misassemblies, other kinds of errors in it still.
So there's some feeling like even in the current release, there may be some disassemblies.
Absolutely.
Which means something may be inverted or inside the wrong place.
Yes, I mean, some of them have quite interesting causes, and we were able to correct one just in the last few weeks, and what had happened here in that case was that there was a gap in the sequence, and then the sequence on this side was rather similar to the sequence on that side, and if you looked carefully, then what you could see was that would actually this sequence was identical to this sequence, and that sequence was identical to that sequence. And what had happened was that this was a polymorphism in the genome, where some alleles had, this was 120 kb segments here, and other alleles didn't. And in this case, the reference sequence, or the individual contributing to the reference sequence, had both alleles. This allele had been correctly joined to the sequence on that side, and this allele had been correctly joined to the sequence on the other side. But what it hadn't been realized was that actually these were just alternative alleles. So in this case, just by reinterpreting the sequence, it was possible to improve the assembly and remove a gap and so on. And so some of the gaps may be due to the sequences that are kind of recalcitrant to the molecular methods used to determine the sequence. But I think an increasing proportion of them will be due to interpretation difficulties like that.
So how would you estimate at the moment the relative weight of actually sequencing errors with respect to the natural variation? Because at some point, there.
So the people who generate the genome sequence set a target of one base error per 10,000 bases, and by all tests that have been done, they achieved that or better. Whereas the base variants that you find in DNA are typically one every one kilobase. So the error rate in the reference sequence is below the polymorphism rate that you find if you look at sequences.
Do you consider these copy number variations also as those polymorphisms?
Absolutely. There's a usage in the field where polymorphism means something at a frequency in the population of above 1%. Yes, if there's a copy number variant that's more frequent than 1%, it would be just considered as a copy number polymorphism. But how to incorporate incorporate polymorphism information or variation information into the reference sequence is a kind of informatics question that people are still thinking about. And in some cases, it's just kind of added on, but in other cases, the alternative alleles can be so different that it's useful to have different assemblies for the different alleles. So in some parts of the genome, like the HLA region, I think already, if you go and look at that in the genome browser, then you'll have the option of choosing different versions of it to use as your reference. Okay, but to new technology. There are a number of these new technologies. I'll just talk about one, the Selexa or Illumina technology, and the others differ in their molecular details, but they share really two key properties. One is that the reads that they give are much shorter than those 500, 700 base pair reads. And the other thing is that they have much higher error rates. So with Selexa, what's typically done now is to fragment DNA to about 200 base pairs. then adapters are attached to the ends, and there's a limited amplification step.
Chris, can I ask you to elaborate on what you just said? So you're going to talk about one technology, but there are many competing new
technologies. There are kind of three.
So in the past, you know, 2 or 3 years, I've heard many people talking about how their technology or the technology they're using is going to be the best thing. And I'm sort of in the position of somebody who waited until 2002 to buy the first computer, that I have no idea, like, if I'm buying used cars or if I'm buying a really great product. So among people in the know, is it clear which technology is going to be the winner 5 years from now? Or are we really in a situation where there's multiple really good technologies and we just haven't decided yet which is going to be VHS and which is going to be beta?
I think it's very clear that in 5 years' time, none of these technologies will be around. That the field is developing so rapidly, and there are such new attractive technologies on the horizon that I'm pretty sure that all of these three will be obsolete in a shorter time period than 5 years.
Is 454 going to be one of the companies you'll talk about?
So 454 is one of the three, but that was the one I was not going to talk about. So the reason for that is that for us it's about 10 times cheaper than standard sequencing, whereas the other two, which are Celexa and AB Solid, are 100 to 1,000 times cheaper. So 454 has some features that make it easier to use. The reads are not as short as these, but it's just too expensive for the really large scale applications. Okay, so there's some small amount of amplification of these in solution, and then you have a plate, and single molecules are just spotted at random onto that. And then there's a second amplification step in situ on the plate. And this is just so that you generate what are called little clusters of molecules that make the sequencing signal easier to detect. And then there's a cyclic procedure where you add by synthesis the first base to the whole plate, and each base is labeled with a different color. So if these two have A's, then they'll show up one color in their first base. If this has a C, it'll show up a different color, and so on for G and T. Then that.
So this thing is now cycled as in the PCR machine, so the single strands that we're working with now?
So it's primed onto single strands, yes. But everything is held into a small area of the plate. So after adding the fluorescent label, you image this plate. You then remove the label. You remove a block to the addition of more bases, and then you can add a second base, and you can carry on doing this for a number of cycles. Typically, 40 to 50 million of these spots on one plate. So that's really the advantage, that it's firstly small, so it uses very low amounts of material, and secondly, it's highly parallel, so you can generate a lot of data in each experiment. And then the sequencing here is again generally done from the two ends, a paired ends, but the reads are 35 bases at each end. So that means that in one sequencing run, we can now generate essentially 3 gigabases of data, one times coverage of something the size of the human genome or the gorilla genome. And the cost of that for the sequencing alone, $10,000 maybe. When you add on the extra costs of preparing the libraries and storing the information, it's still only a factor of a few times that. So much, much cheaper than generating one times coverage by previous methods. So you can make these fragments of different sizes if you want. There are technically a little bit more difficult than that kind of fragmentation and preparation, but there are now protocols that will give you a, say, 3 kilobase distance between your inserts. And all of the data that we've had up to now is with these 35 base reads, but the technology is developing so rapidly that there are protocols to go to 50 or 70 bases already. It's really improving quickly. But the other important issue here is the errors. So one way to look at this is for each base, say base number 10 in your sequence, then when the image is recorded, you can look at the channel for the color corresponding to each base. So you can see a signal corresponding to AC, G or T, and it might be that this base is a C and you get a strong signal, but the signals from the other bases are still detectable. That is quantitated as estimating the chance that your sequence is really a C compared with something else, and expressed as a Q value, where Q20 would mean it's 100 times more likely to be a C than one of the other bases, Q30 1,000 times, so on.
So then these other signals would come from the neighboring bases, or would it just be noise?
They would be the sum of all of those things. That yes, actually, these, in reality, these clusters are as tight as you can get them, and touching, and you have to set criteria for kind of how well distinguished you want your cluster to be. But also there are errors in all of these copying processes, and then the limitation on the length of the sequence is that all of the chemical steps in the reaction are not 100%. They might be 99.99% efficient, but by the time most of your molecules have got to 10 cycles, by the time you've gone through 10 cycles and most of your molecules have been extended by 10 nucleotides, a few will only have been extended by 9 because something didn't work. So you'll start to get the base from the previous cycle, maybe. So what you notice is that if you plot a cycle from 1 to 35 against error, then it increases during the cycle, and the mean error that you have to deal with is about 1%. That is a very, for us, a very high error rate, and something that has to be kind of factored into all of the uses of the data. Okay, so using this approach, we've now generated 25, 30 times genome coverage of this gorilla, and we're now at the stage of thinking about how to use that to extend the information that we have here. So as a result of this kind of analysis, there will be contigs here. And the Celexa reads, some of them will, or most of them will map onto these, but some will map onto the ends and can be used to extend these, we hope, and to cross the gaps. But when we come to do this, then there's another consideration, and that is the mapping of a 35 base sequence or a pair of 35 base sequences onto a large genome. Because although 35 bases is large enough such that if the genome of 3 times 10 to the 9 bases were a random sequence, 35 bases would be unique, then the human genome and the gorilla genome are not random sequences. They're full of repeated sequences. So often a 35 base read will map to more than one location in the genome. There's then a question of what do you do with that? You can decide not to use it at all. You can maybe choose the best location. But if there are several equally good locations, then what do you do? You can assign randomly to those, or you might try to use additional information from the other pair. Paired end, for example, to map. So those are the issues that we're really thinking about at the point of generating the gorilla assembly, and before moving on, I just mention one more aspect that relates to population genetics, and that is, I've drawn this as if there's one animal called a gorilla, But actually, if you look at this part of the tree in more detail, then what you find is that there are actually two distinct species of gorillas called gorilla reasonably and gorilla beringii, and these are western gorillas, these are eastern gorillas. And if you've heard about the gorillas in the mist, the mountain gorillas, they're actually one of what people consider two subtypes of gorilla beringii. So most of the field studies have been done on gorilla beringii, whereas virtually all of the zoo animals and all of the genetics, has, including the reference sequence, is being done on gorilla. We would like to be able to extend the sequencing and genotyping to some additional gorilla samples. But there are very big practical difficulties in doing that, both because of the small numbers of these gorillas in the world. The numbers are measured in a few hundreds, at least for some of the types, but also on the legislation that is designed to protect them, that makes it very difficult to transport and use any samples for scientific purposes. So that's also something that we're thinking about and wondering what is the most useful kind of study design in a case where we will have very restricted samples to use. But I hope that it'll be possible to generate some sequence data from at least one beringii gorilla and get some idea of the of how genetically distinct they are.
If you have like 35-fold coverage of one individual,
yep.
Is it? I mean, why would you? Why do you go so high in the coverage of a single individual? I could imagine, for example, you took 3-fold coverage of 10 individuals, and you might get some polymorphism information for free. So what is the rationale in determining whether you take it from one individual or from several?
Okay, so I was going to come on to this when talking about how we use similar data to look at human variation, but we can cover it now. So imagine that you have one. That this is your genome sequence, and there's one position here, and you want to know what it is in sequence that you've generated by this technology. And let's say you know that it's a G in the genome. Then you have a number of reads that cover this position, and when we're interested in polymorphism data, then we want to see and call both alleles. So for these error rates become quite important. So if we would look at the first read and see an A there, then could we conclude that actually this is a variable position in the genome, and that in this case it's really an A? Well, no, we couldn't, because it could equally well be an error with a fairly high chance. So as a kind of rule of thumb, then what people require is that they see the same nucleotide at least twice in two independent reads, and will then accept that that is a genuine variant and not an artifact. So if we want to call polymorphisms within an individual, then we want to be able to see each allele at this position twice. And the number of reads to give us a 99% chance of that each allele is seen twice, if I recall correctly, is 11. So is 11-fold coverage enough? We want 11-fold coverage of, let's say, 99% of the genome. So there's variation in the level of the coverage from base to base. So in order to have 99% confidence of seeing both alleles twice in 99% of the genome, then we need something like 27 times coverage. And that's because there's quite a lot of observed variation in the level of coverage. It's worse than a random distribution. So that's the thinking behind if you want to really know the sequence of one individual with these error-prone approaches, then you have to go to as high coverage as that.
Now I have to figure out how to split it to go up.
How all those errors, stochastic or do you have systematic errors?
What
locations where you at a very high rate you might narrow?
So, I mean, that's something that people are just starting to look at. But we know that there are two fundamental types of error. That one is that this copying process here is error prone. So if in copying from this molecule to this molecule you generate an error here, then even if you have perfect sequencing, you will call the wrong base with very high confidence when you do this. So those errors are more or less random, as far as we know. These kind of errors we don't know so much about. I think that there are likely to be some subtle patterns of correlation between them. And in some of the different technologies, like the 454 technology, then in that case there's a particular problem with calling runs of a nucleotide, that you can't distinguish between, say, 5 A's in a row and 6 A's in a row.
Had you, for example, taken this information from, say, 5 individuals or something like that, wouldn't the error part and the so for those positions which are not polymorphic in the population, the error analysis would be the same, in the sense that you would get the same amount of confidence than if you had taken it from one individual. But at the same time, then you would see that there are some actual varying positions. in that sample. So my question is, how far does it make sense to get a single sequence much more accurately than the level of variation in the population?
Well, I think the thinking is partly that base substitution variation is not the only kind of variation between individuals. That in addition to that, there are structural rearrangements. And that here we're already kind of trying out a new method that hasn't been applied on this kind of scale before. So I suppose we wanted to play safe and just see if it's possible to do it with one individual, and then, you know, if that turns out to be reasonably feasible, then, you know, maybe the next group who are sequencing the bonobo or something, you know, can take a strategy, a more permissive strategy, a more efficient strategy like yours. Okay, so now,
if you were to take the convenience, wouldn't you have more problems in reassembling the genome, for example, in this case?
Yes, I think that's the concern. So that's one of the main reasons for wanting to go to such high depth on a single individual.
So it's not in the sense of the fact that you get different individuals, you have more problems in reassembling.
Yes, that you get SNPs, but you will have less confidence in your assembly. And I suppose this is a project to generate a gorilla reference sequence. And if we can generate other information, that's a bonus, but it's not the primary aim of the project. And we don't want the primary aim to suffer too much.
So how far along are you actually in implementing?
Well, so the two times data are there, and think they'll be available in pre-ensemble in the next release sometime this year. And then the 25 times or so Selexa data are there, and people are exploring ways of doing this with them. The target was to generate a hybrid assembly by the end of this year, and whether that will be done or not will depend on how easy it is. Okay, so now I thought that before going straight into the 1,000 genomes analysis, I would talk a little bit about human evolution and some of the background to that, and thinking about different human populations that we might want to sample. So most of our so what we're looking at is this part of the tree, and most of our information there comes from studies of fossils, and it's been enormously popular among fossil hunters for the last 100 years or more. So although these hominid fossils are extremely rare and difficult to find, such that if someone finds one nice example in their whole career, then that's a big success and we remember their name. But still, enough people have been motivated to do that we now have, you know, quite a lot of fossils on this branch and a reasonable understanding. So So if we kind of expand this part of the tree, now say from 3 million down to modern humans, then the species around at this time were Australopithecus, and you might have heard of Lucy, an Australopithecus, I think, dating from around 3.5 million years ago. And then the first Homo appears in the fossil record at a time which depends on your definition of the genus, but somewhere between about 2.4 and 1.9 million years ago, and at this time there were species that are that are variously called Agaster or Erectus by different people. That's about 1.9 million years ago, and these were species that had bodies pretty much like us. That upright walking was a very early development. So all of these are walking upright. But Homo erectus, 1.9 million years ago, was as tall as us, the same body proportions, except that the brain was about half the size of ours. This species, Homo erectus, spread outside Africa, where all of this early part of the evolution is occurring, through much of the old world to places like China, Java, where if you've heard of Peking Man, then Peking Man is Homo erectus. And survived, according to some people, until pretty recently, maybe around 30,000 or 40,000 years ago, and other species like the hobbits from Flores that were around even to about 12,000 years ago are considered by most people to be some kind of a offshoot of Homo erectus. Other archaic hominids around a million to half a million years ago, something like Heidelbergensis was around, and that is considered by most people to be the ancestor of Neanderthals. Who also survived until around 30,000 years ago in parts of Europe. For most of our history, then humans have there have been multiple species of humans or hominids, rather like the multiple species of multiple types of gorilla or indeed chimpanzees that we now see, and all of these seem to have been very rare species. So now I mean, our situation where there's just one type of human and we've spread out over the whole world and we're present at 6 or 7 billion of us, and that biologically is the exception for our according to our biology, and from a biological point of view points to some rather interesting and exceptional things happening on our lineage. So what we can do again is kind of focus down on to this part of the lineage, the last 100,000 years ago or so. So when thinking about what's going on here, it's also useful to take into account the climate, because it's really dominated our history. So if we have cold and warm, then at present we're living in a warm climate. But that's only been the case for the last 10,000 years or so. That before that, at 20,000 years ago, there was a glacial maximum. It was very cold. Before that, it fluctuated quite a lot, but tended to be much colder than at present. The last time that it was as warm as the present was around 100,000 years ago or a bit earlier, in the previous interglacial period. The other thing that's useful to think about is the distinction between modern human anatomy and modern human behavior. So modern human anatomy is different from other species, and even to a non-expert, say the difference between a Neanderthal skull and a modern human skull is quite obvious. So we can ask when modern human anatomy first appears in the fossil record, and that's around 200,000 years ago, with fossils like Omo 1 from Ethiopia. So modern human anatomy again appears first in Africa. But from my way of thinking, it wasn't really a very special development. It didn't seem to make us very successful, not very numerous, but these anatomically modern humans did expand out of Africa a little bit. They were present in the Levant in Israel at around this time, when the climate was warm. People have sometimes interpreted that as the first out of Africa contribution to us, but that's wrong. That was a temporary expansion, a dead end. And when the climate got cold again, then the modern humans who were in Israel either migrated back to Africa or went extinct. But then in this period, again in Africa, you see the appearance in the archaeological record of modern behavior. So that's shown up as things like the use of more complex tools, incorporating different kinds of materials, long distance trading, according to some people, the first signs of art appearing. So by sometime a little bit before 50,000 years ago, perhaps 60 or 70,000 years ago, there were in Africa both anatomically and behaviorally modern humans. And then these people spread a lot both within Africa, and a very small number of them seem to have migrated out of Africa one time and expanded to all of the rest of the world. So all humans outside Africa share the same pool of genes, have lower diversity than those within Africa, other things that go with it, like longer regions of linkage disequilibrium. And if we're thinking about the divergences between populations outside Africa, then the time scale is less than 50,000 years ago, perhaps quite a lot less than that. So any questions at this stage, or should we stop for a break soon?
So this spreading after 50,000 years ago is what gave rise to the extinction of the other species as well, the other human species?
So that's something that people debate, but in my view, then almost certainly that the coincidences are just so remarkable that when anatomically modern humans came to Europe, then there was a very brief transition period where you can see in the archaeological record that Neanderthals are starting to adopt some of the technology, at least of modern humans, but then rapidly go extinct. And it's not just Neanderthals, but a whole lot of large animals go extinct at about the time when modern humans appear in a region of the world. And to me, it's just too much of a coincidence to be due to anything other than the appearance of modern humans.
And this human evolution, is it concentrated or gradual?
I'm sorry, yes.
If we plot, let's say, brain size versus time, is it the punctuated nature or is it gradual increasing?
I'm not sure that we really have enough fossil data to plot on that kind of scale, but if we would put time with the present here, and you know a couple of million years ago here, then the early Homo species were, say, 500, 600, 700 cc's for their brain size. Neanderthals, let's say a few hundred thousand years ago, had larger brains than us. Uh, 1500 cc's or more, our brains concentrate around this mainly in the, I think, 1200 cc range. But the, you know, the number of points that you have on this plot where you really know with any accuracy the brain size is pretty limited. So it's certainly not a uniformly increasing size, because we have smaller brains than humans who were around a little while ago, but whether it's some kind of smooth curve or whether it would really go like that, I don't know.
The idea that it's not a very old variation in Africa compared to modern the rest of the people in the world often surprises people. It's not exactly intuitive. So Cameron's explained.
No, but I think that that there's a whole history of people wanting to see themselves as distinct from other animals and other people, and you know, 100 years ago, at the time of Darwin, the idea that humans were a kind of ape was a, you know, a controversial, provoking idea, and you know, even 50 years ago, the idea that humans were had split from apes this kind of time rather than 20-25 million years ago was quite controversial, with the work of Alan Wilson and others strongly favouring the recent time. And then when thinking about modern human evolution, then again for many years there was a kind of multi-regional idea of human evolution, whereby over the last couple of million years different humans or different human characteristics had developed in different parts of the world and had gradually kind of coalesced into, I shouldn't use that that word, but had contributed to the modern human phenotype and genotype, and you know, the actual mechanism of that would be most bizarre, I think. But you know, it seems that the more carefully we look, then the, you know, the more recent our origins are. And I think, I mean, the other thing is that we are kind of hypersensitive to differences between humans and the differences between individuals, and probably to a, you know, to an E. coli, all humans look pretty much the same. In our social lives, it's very important that we can tell one person from another, and also kind of tell our social group maybe from other social groups. So our sense of these differences is probably heightened out of proportion to the genetic differences. But also, I mean, maybe that's something that's been selected for. And it's quite interesting that in some of the studies that we've done that I wasn't proposing to go into here, but following up signals or potential signals of positive selection in the human genome, then one way of picking those out is to look for SNPs that are at present at different frequencies in different populations. And in fact, the HapMap project did that on a large and fairly comprehensive scale. So we have good lists of SNPs that are present at very different frequencies in different populations. And if you refine those to look at the ones that, that do seem to show real signals of positive selection and ask what kind of genes they lie in, then several of them are in genes like SLC24A5, I think it is, that determines skin color, or EDAR, which is a determinant of hair morphology, that it seems that the visual appearance probably has been strongly selected for in human history. But now the reasons for that a bit unsure.
Selection or selection on fitness?
Well, it's got to be selection on fitness, but whether that is through mate choice or kind of some other mechanism, I think the genetics doesn't tell us. I mean, my prejudice would be for sexual selection, but I'm not sure that I could really justify that. You know, why do we have light colour in Europe, light skin colour in Europe? That some people have argued for kind of environmental effects, but to me those are not very strong. So,
talking yesterday, the day before, trying to estimate the age of the most recent common ancestor for nuclear genes. I don't think you had mentioned one that was a couple hundred thousand, 500,000 years. What's the range?
Yeah, these are population splits. These are not gene coalescences.
Yeah, I know.
So typically,
kind of contrast, because here you're talking about modern behavior, appearing 70,000 years ago, and Homo at 200,000. Now we're just talking about gene polymorphism.
Yeah, so that typical coalescence would be a million years.
Primary tree was around that, 700,000 to a million years.
Yes. Yes, but I would guess that among the neutral variants that show those kind of coalescences, there are going to be some genetic variants that contributed to this and will show more recent coalescences. So I think that being able to identify those would be very interesting.
Yeah, but I'm just going to get some sense, by and large, the ancestors relevant to understanding the polymorphism of typical love size, maybe go back 500,000 years, 200, a million in that range, maybe.
I get quite a long way back, I think.
So how could a coalescent gene manage to go back much farther than this out of Africa time?
Well, the genes still go there.
Yes.
But you have to maintain a polymorphism in a very small population that came out of Africa.
But I think it was small, but not one or two people. That people are thinking about effective population sizes of maybe 1,000 or so for ones that came out of Africa. And so that would have been sufficient to maintain lineages going back for a million years.
There's only a few lineages in this modern.
Yeah.
You're making the distinction there between modern behavior and modern anatomy.
Yeah.
And you're pointing out that even once we have the modern anatomy, there's no indication that that was sufficient to distinguish us from all these other creatures who weren't wildly successful or something. So something else changed. About 100,000 years after we had that anatomy to get us the modern behavior. Now, is it clear whether that's related to other changes that aren't, genetic changes that aren't reflected in the anatomy, or to what extent could that be due to cultural evolution, Anna?
So I think undoubtedly cultural evolution was happening here, but I suppose the question I would ask is are there genetic changes kind of predisposing, allowing that cultural evolution to take place?
Or an interaction between the two.
Yeah, and I think the most the most interesting suggestion, although provocative and virtually unverifiable, is that the key thing that happened here was language. Although animals have communication systems, then human language is really very different from those. And it's easy to tell stories whereby the development of complex modern language would have been an enormous advantage to the people who could perform it, and so they could have swept through Africa and the world in that kind of a way. But
is there also a popular story coupling cultural change to climate change? I mean, is there a storyline that when it got cold, people started making language or something?
I mean, I haven't heard of that. During this unfavorable period, then in far northern and southern places, then there would have been ice. But in Africa, it was never freezing, and the climate changed in other ways, that maybe in terms of how wet and dry it was, and the kind of vegetation. So, I think very likely that there must have been very complex effects there, but kind of how we can get insights into those, I'm not very sure about.
You think language was caused by some major biological change to some individual that then started to reproduce in a sort of selective way?
I mean, I think if there was a single mutation that led to language, then we would see reversion of that mutation. So there would be people who were perfectly ordinary in every respect, except that they didn't have language ability, and no such person has ever been reported. So I think we can probably rule out the idea that it was a single mutation, but whether it was 10 or 100 or 1,000, I'm not sure how we can kind of get at that.
If there's a boost of cultural evolution, and that in turn would have introduced new selection pressures,
yes,
genetic ones, so would those be traceable? Or?
So in principle you can look at the genomes of a population, you can work out which bits have been selected recently, and for which bits selection started, let's say, 70,000 years ago, and then you can ask, what are the genes there? What are the functional elements? What are they doing? So, I think that's one thing that the field can do in the next few years.
So, is anything known about whether Neanderthals had language?
It's very much debated, but I don't think that there's anything in their anatomy that would have said that they couldn't have had language. So as I understand it, they could have, but whether they did, we don't know.
What about interbreeding? Would that have been possible?
Yeah, I mean, that's an interesting question for all of these species that have modern humans, or did modern humans interbreed with them? And again, I think that's something that's debated, but not really resolved. But I think we can rule out a large contribution to the modern human genome from these species. And for specific loci like mitochondrial DNA that have been studied in enormous numbers of people, then it would be pretty obvious if there was a Neanderthal or an Erectus mitochondrial DNA there, and nothing has been found. So there's no direct support for genes coming from archaic humans, but it's very difficult to rule out a small contribution, and you know, if you find regions of the genome with coalescences, you know, going back 2 million years, 3 million years, which, although are not the major part of the genome, are not that rare, then there's the possibility that they could have been contributed by some of these archaic humans. And people have argued in specific cases that was the origin of something that they found, but I think we don't really know for sure in any particular case.
I was going to say, if you're interested, then you probably should try to talk to Dick, because I don't know if you're a co-author.
Yeah, or an advisor or something like that. But
yeah, so
I think when you're arguing based on specific kinds of evidence for a Neanderthal contribution to variation analogous, I don't think he believes it. It's just some kind of evidence that sort of challenges.
There's some patterns that look consistent with it, but I'm not sure it's really convincing. I mean, it's.
Yeah, if you're interested in the kind of patterns.
Mm. Anyway, do people want to have a short break? We just. So the last thing that I'll talk about will be the 1,000 Genomes Project. So this was stimulated by the availability of new cheap sequencing technologies. So people could see that it was possible to begin doing large-scale resequencing of whole human genomes. And interest in doing that was sort of combined into this project. So it's important to appreciate, firstly, that it's a medical genetics project. It's not really to look at human evolution or population structure or the kind of things that we might be interested in, but its primary aim is to inform medical genetics, and I think that's understandable given the resources and expense that it will involve. But when thinking along those lines, people wanted to identify specific goals for it. So one was to to discover all SNPs present at a frequency of greater than or equal to 1% in the population. And all clearly doesn't mean all. At this level, it means kind of 99% of those that are in the part of the genome that's accessible to these sequencing technologies, which because of the mapping problems is not the whole genome, but is something like 80 to 90% of the genome. And you know, what 1% means, is that 1% in the sample that you're sequencing, is it 1% in the population that sample is derived from, is it 1% in the world population, then that's something that we can come back to. So functional region SNPs present at lower frequency than this, and the project doesn't seem to have quite decided whether this should be 0.5% or 0.1%, but the goal will be somewhere in this level. And also to discover a lot of structural variation. And this kind of variation is so complicated to describe that at the beginning of the project there weren't really any specific goals defined for structural variation, except that it would be a very important part of the project. So I guess around a year ago then people started discussing in some detail about how goals like these could be achieved. And so I think this word is used to mean coding plus the other regions that people think are interesting. So yes, could include regulatory regions. There's some question about how well those are identified and how well they're annotated, but I think this phrase is used to indicate that the project would like to include those. And I suppose the reason why this would be useful for medical genetics is that now people are often doing association studies where they find a SNP that's associated with a disease, say type 2 diabetes. But what they find is quite likely not the functional SNP. It's just a SNP that marks a region, and in some cases quite a large region. It could be hundreds of kilobases of DNA. So the idea is that or now what they have to do is go and resequence that region in lots of individuals to discover additional variants, including they hope the functional one, and then try and work out which is doing which. So what that means is that there are a lot of people doing these things, but individually according to the genes their association studies land on. So if this was coordinated into one single project, then that would be a efficient way of doing it for medical genetics. So we would start with a complete catalogue of variants down to these frequencies, and people wanting to do medical genetic association studies could get on with those quicker. And that argument seems to have been reasonably convincing to the funding agencies.
With the caveat, there's absolutely no medical or phenotypic information about these thousand individuals.
Right? Absolutely. This project is done in individuals from the general population whose disease status is completely unknown. So this project is purely to discover these variants. It's not to associate them with any kind of phenotype. and that has to be done in separate projects.
So in some cases, actually, it's important not to choose 1,000 individuals who are healthy, for example, but actually represent the process.
You're searching for that diabetes allele. You've excluded people who...
Yes, I suppose that the thinking is that those alleles will have such small effects that you will still find the diabetes allele in very healthy people.
Are you going to describe how the individuals were chosen or are chosen?
Yes, I can come on to that. But having decided on these rough goals, I think people realized that they didn't know how to achieve them. So the normal procedure in that situation is to set up some pilot projects. Towards the end of last year and launched at the beginning of this year were three pilot projects. So one was to do low coverage. Of many individuals, and we'll come on to what those mean in a minute. The second was to do two trios, meaning mother, father, child sets at high coverage. And the third was to do 1,000 genes in around 1,500 individuals at high coverage. So here, the initial target was set at 2 times genome coverage, and for the pilot, 180 individuals. This was set at something like 20 plus times. Coverage, and this wasn't very well defined. So as we discussed earlier when we talked about detecting SNPs, then if we want to discover all the variants in one individual, then we have to go to this kind of coverage. So this part of the project was to design to essentially discover the full set of variants in the four parents, and then having the children would provide some checks on that and information on phase and other things. But even with the new technologies, it would be too expensive to do this many individuals at this kind of coverage. So the idea coming particularly from Richard Durbin was that it would be possible to achieve these goals by not discovering all of the variants in single individuals, but rather by discovering the shared variants, and maybe something along the lines of that you were thinking of. So in order to call a SNP, we would want to see it at least twice, but that twice could be in two different individuals, and that would be sufficient to say that that variant existed. It would, would go into that catalog. Then what populations should be used? And I think the main issue there was informed consent, that an essential part of this project was that the data would be made freely available via the web to everyone without any restrictions. And so it's considered that that kind of spreading of information required a special kind of informed consent from the donors. And there was only one set of samples that really had that informed consent, and that was the HapMap samples. So do people know what the HapMap project is? Or should I say a few words about that? Okay, so that was a project that was started in around 2002, and its aim was to define the patterns of common variation in the human genome. And common variation meaning more than 5% in that case. So it used four populations, 270 individuals. There were 30 trios, abbreviated as YRI, which are Yorubans from Nigeria in Africa. 30 CEU, which are Seth Europeans from Utah, so people of European ancestry, but actually sampled in the US in Utah. Then 45 Chinese Han from Beijing, and 45. Japanese from Tokyo, and then these samples were collected, and they were converted into cell lines. So there are lymphoblastoid cell lines readily available from Coriell, from all of these, and that was a very useful aspect of the project, although quite a laborious and expensive one, because it means that, as well as the HapMap project itself, lots of other projects could take advantage of the same samples and then take advantage of all the work that had been done and the information that was already available for the HapMap. So in the first phase, they were typed with 1 million SNPs, and in the second phase with 3 million SNPs. So to give you a sense of scale, it's kind of guessed that there are around 10 million SNPs at, I guess, more than this kind of frequency in the genome. So a significant proportion of the SNPs that are present in our genomes. As a result of that, LD patterns are now quite well understood in these population samples. It's been shown that these samples are reasonably representative of populations from other parts of the world that were not sampled. And so on the basis of the information that came out of this project, then efficient SNP typing chips could be designed so that while genotyping 10 million SNPs or even 3 million SNPs in an association study was beyond the possibilities a few years ago, and even now is not really possible, then still on the basis of this project, sets of a few hundred thousand SNPs could be picked out that would tag the LD blocks and so allow efficient association studies to be carried out. So the project was an important part of human genetics, medical genetics for several years, and has proved very useful, and its legacy in terms of the information and the samples continues. So these individuals were carefully consented for the release of essentially full genetic information, so they could be used straight away for the Thousand Genomes project. So what went into it were 60 YRI, 60 CEU, 30 this part of the project has now been virtually finished. Because sequencing technology has improved even during the few months that the project's been going, it's possible to increase this from two times to up to four times for many of these individuals. This part has also been done, and I don't know what the exact coverage is, but it's well over this figure. And I should perhaps say who's doing this work, that my institute, Sanger, is one contributor, but also the BGI, the Beijing Genomics Institute in China, and in the US, three institutes, the Broad Institute, Baylor, and WashU, are doing this. And then one of the factors that helped to allow the increase in the amount of information was that the sequencing companies decided to join the project. So now Illumina, 454 and Applied Biosystems are also contributing sequence data. So as well as generating information, it will also allow a direct comparison of those technologies in terms of their coverage and error rates and so on. So these parts of the pilot essentially done. There's a data freeze within the last few weeks that showed that I think 1.6 terabases of sequence had been deposited, which is more than the whole amount of sequence available previously, and is 500 more than 500 times coverage of the human genome, and the data are freely available to anyone who wants to access them and use them. So that's almost all I want to say. I just finish maybe by saying a little bit about this approach to the sequencing. Because one drawback of the new sequencing technologies, or potential drawback, is that they're wonderful if you want to sequence a whole human genome. But what about if you just want to sequence one gene or a small number of genes? Still, the amount of data that you get is determined by the machine. So, you know, it's rather expensive and overkill to put your 10 kilobases of DNA onto that machine and get thousands or millions of times coverage. So that's one aspect. And here, in the human genome, there's judged to be something like 20,000 genes. And this part of the project wants to look at 1,000 of those genes. But how do you pick out the 1,000 genes from all of the rest of the DNA and sequence those specifically? The technology for doing that is really still under development. So this part of the project is going more slowly. But there are two ways in which you can approach this. The traditional way would be just to PCR amplify each bit of DNA separately to pull those together and then sequence the pool. And that is feasible for reasonably small numbers of sequences. If you wanted to do 100 sequences, that would be a reasonable approach. But when you get to thousands in this number of individuals, then it becomes both very expensive and very laborious. So it's attractive to have alternative methods of doing it that scale more easily. And the ways that are being used are variants of a kind of hybrid capture approach. It's easy to specify the sequence of an oligonucleotide and synthesize that. So you can synthesize a chosen oligonucleotide of, say, 50 bases corresponding to one of the regions that you're interested in doing. And this can be attached to a surface. And the technology to do this for hundreds of thousands or even millions of oligonucleotides exists. So what people have been trying have been using this kind of array and then hybridizing total DNA to them, taking the DNA that binds, eluting that, and then putting that pool into the sequencing procedures. Those techniques work to some extent. They tend to introduce other sources of uneven coverage, and so further complications in calling SNPs and interpreting the results. But I think that's the best hope for being able to do this part of this project, and also lots of small-scale projects that people would want to do on their individual lab scale rather than on a genome center scale.
Just a you say 1,000 genes, that's both coding and non-coding regions?
So that wasn't very well defined by the project. I think it means the parts of 1,000 genes that the people doing the experiment were interested in. But the intention was that it would be something more than just the coding region. So this is the pilot project. It's quite well on course, and the data available. The full project is intended to take 3 years from the time of launch at the beginning of this year. The last thing that I can say is perhaps a bit about the design of that full project. That clearly more samples than these are needed, and how should those samples be chosen in order to be able to meet these aims of the project. So there, that's where the question of what does this 1% really mean becomes important. That if it's just 1% in your sample, then you can sequence anything and expect to detect that. But that wouldn't be a very useful thing to do, because people want to be able to use the data in their own samples that might be a European population but not the CEU. So the goal that was set here is that it should be 1% in a population that's similar to one of these. So European, Bantu-speaking African or East Asian origin. So that raises the question of what does similar to mean? And that question is still under debate, but the kind of answer that people are suggesting is something like an FST value of about 0.5%. So that FST value would allow most European populations to be seen as one kind of cluster, and many East Asian populations and so on. So having decided on that goal, then how should the number of samples be divided between specific populations, say between specific European populations, and somehow the project increased the number of individuals that it wanted to sequence from 1,000 to around 1,500. The logic of that wasn't entirely clear, and no one really raised any objection to it, and the name hasn't been changed. But the idea is that from each of these geographical regions, or each of these ancestry regions, around 500 individuals will be sequenced, and so you can imagine those samples being chosen at one extreme, that all 500 come from one sample, from one population, at the other extreme that all 500 would come from different samples, different populations, and what would the best design be. And essentially the more populations you would sample, then the more chance you would have to detect variants that are relatively frequent in one population but maybe rarer in the others. So according to that way of thinking, you would spread your 500 as widely as possible. But because the analysis depends on having populations that can be analyzed as units, then there's a size requirement for that population. And the current thinking is that it would be useful to have something like 100 individuals per population. So now the design looks like something like 5 times 100, and that times 3 regions. And then most of those samples don't exist. So it's necessary to go and collect them and to establish cell lines. So there is some opportunity there for input into what new samples should be collected.
How much information is stored besides whether they are from Europe or China?
The very little. So it's important that they are anonymous and have no phenotype information associated with them. So there's no medical information. I think that there'll be place of birth and maybe parents and grandparents, place of birth, language, that maybe what they call themselves, their ethnicity, but virtually nothing beyond that.
Why don't they just do their own medical information anonymously at the same time?
I think the way of thinking is that, you know, that kind of project would be very useful, but that's just a different project. This project is aimed at discovering variants. It's not aimed at linking them to phenotype information.
But that bit seems easy compared with what you're doing. I mean, you just get them to fill in a big survey form at the same time.
But I think in terms of actually getting the project done, then setting up the mechanisms to do that, getting the ethical approval, getting the procedures in place, you're talking about years to get those things done. So in practice, if we want to get this project finished within 3 years, then I think there isn't time to do that. But, you know, if you're studying animals or bacteria or something that you can just go and sample, it's easy. But when you're working with humans, all these other factors come in that really should be in, you know, a high profile project absolutely must be taken very seriously.
Near the end, just to be provocative, it seems like a lot of the sort of rational decisions you're trying to make about strength of the sample is really just pure window dressing. That it's really just kind of a pseudoscientific, you know, analysis to make it sound like it's all entirely kosher and well thought through. And the reason I say that is, I don't know how many humans there are in the world. 4 billion, 8 billion, 4?
6 or 7 billion.
So 1% frequency would mean that things are present 70 million times, 60, 70 million times. In the world.
Yes, so this 1% turns out to be
1% allele frequency.
1% in these populations. Or in these populations.
So, so you're talking about things. In population genetic terms, that's pretty common actually, in some sense. I mean, there's no clear distinction in population terms. What's constitutes a rare lineage. The 1% is pretty arbitrary. And so something that's already present, well, there's that many people, it's twice as many alleles. And so I'm just wondering, perhaps an allele that is present in the world 7 million times or 14 million times perhaps is very medically relevant.
Absolutely.
Perhaps there's an awful lot of that variation that ends up contributing to all manner of complex disease, blah, blah, blah.
Yeah, I think that's one of the
common stuff about 1% that's relevant.
Yeah, the big debates in human genetics now. That one of the debates in medical genetics that essentially is common disease due to common variants, or is it due to a very diverse set of rare variants? And there are examples where common diseases are associated with common variants. And association studies that can be done now can only detect associations due to reasonably common variants. And people are very pleased with the success that those association studies have had in the last year or two, because they do identify lots of variants that are solidly associated with phenotypes. But those variants only account for a tiny proportion of the disease. So most of the genetic susceptibility is still totally unknown. Its basis is still totally unknown. And it could be due to common variants with smaller and smaller effects that will show up as larger samples are used in association studies. But it could be due to essentially de novo mutations, very, very rare mutations. And in that case, the association studies won't detect it. So I think in that case, you need to resequence everyone. So you need
the science for these big projects.
Yeah, absolutely.
It's predicated on the idea that 1% seems like a nice number. It seems like it's pretty low. And so let's set that as the goal. In reality, probably the best thing you could say is let's just look at what our technology can give us and how much resources we have, and just base your decision on that, not on some arbitrary, let's get all the ones that are 1%.
But isn't this how it probably happened, that people have just calculated how much can we do in 3 years and then seen what roughly can we do in percentage and then formulated that as a goal?
Yeah, absolutely. The goals are kind of meant to crystallize what is possible. I mean, they're meant to be achievable goals that,
This is really mis-selling some of this stuff to the public, though.
But do you think you could do it in another way?
My view is just like the testing is truthful.
Why is it mis-selling?
What's that?
Why is it mis-selling?
Because I think probably more or less the rationale for this design is, like what can we do in 3 years, where's the technology, and how much money can we expect to get to throw out the project? And then maybe you calculate, oh, it's kind of convenient to think we can get all the SNPs at 1%. But you sell it on the notion that we can get all the SNPs that are 1% or greater.
I mean, I think that you may be being a bit hard, because
I don't know that there's good population genetic reasons for
that in terms of big science. I mean, this project isn't all that expensive. I mean, Sanger isn't getting any extra money to do this. It's just doing it out of its general running budget. So I mean, there's there's no kind of big need to get politicians interested and raise new money, at least for us. But I think that these things also help to kind of focus the thinking of the people involved, and I think that the goals are absolutely set so that they should be achievable, but they're going to be difficult to achieve, so people really have to stretch themselves to achieve them. And that if you just said, well, let's all do some sequencing with the technologies and the money that we have in the next few years, it wouldn't quite have this coherence, and it wouldn't quite do as much as I think an organized project like this will done. So it's coordinated by a series of working groups, say for samples and ethical issues, for data analysis, for data production, and there are half a dozen or so of those groups, and they maybe have 20 people in, although there's quite a lot of overlap between the groups. So 100 kind of core people, but then, I mean, those groups don't contain the people who are doing the real work, maybe, you know, growing the cell lines and extracting the DNA and running the sequencing machines. So they're backed up by a whole lot of extra people.
So did these preliminary studies give a definite idea, like how much of these SNPs are really common among all these among these different ethnic groups, or how many are sort of regionally prevalent?
Yeah, so I think that we know that for high frequency SNPs, and we know that say 85-95% of variation is found within any one population. But that will be different for the rare SNPs, because they will be of more recent origins in general, and are likely to be much more specific, and kind of how that pattern changes when we get down to 1%, 0.1%, and so on. I think we don't really know.
So one general question: how rapidly is the cost of sequencing declining?
Well, I would say, I don't know, I guess maybe halving each year.
So, and well, looking at projects like this, which are designed for time span of 3 years, would it be reasonable just to invest the resources we have now in something else, and then do this kind of sequencing or this large-scale project in 3 years from now, when sequencing is that stuff is essentially for free?
Yeah, I mean, you can always say that, but I think in order for those costs to go down, then, you know, people have to use the technologies. So if everyone did that, it wouldn't work. And also, the first results that you get from an approach are always the most exciting. So.
four that selects, and the other one would be out. What's on the horizon that you mentioned that will make those disappear?
Well, so there are a couple of approaches that are based on really analysis of single molecules. So in one approach, you take a single molecule, single-stranded DNA, and push it through a pore in a membrane and measure some property between the two sides of that, like the might be the conductivity. I'm not sure if that's what they measure. But then as each base passes through the pore, it produces a different change in that. So you can potentially get its sequence from that. And the other kind of approach is where single DNA polymerase molecules are kind of anchored on a surface, and then a DNA strand passes through them, replicating, and then the incorporated molecules can be, I think they must be labeled and are detected. So essentially, as each individual nucleotide is incorporated, then it gives a signal. And both of those approaches can have the advantages of being quite highly parallel, particularly the second one, but giving much longer reads. So potentially kilobase reads. And I think everyone is really looking forward to those kind of things very much. But still translating those ideas into things that actually work on a production scale and a routine basis is an enormous technical challenge. So there's quite a delay between the concept and the prototype and actually...
For example, nanopores, they are at the stage that they can do
what? Well, I think they're at the stage where people have prototype instruments. But it tends to be a bit a combination of secrecy and PR releases and hype, so I'm not involved in any of those technologies. I don't really know what's going on.
Yeah, if the error structure of the different methods is different, for example, you mentioned this thing with the 4-5-4s that you couldn't distinguish 5-A's from 6-A's and this kind of thing. Would it make sense to use a couple of different methods which have different error structures and then compare them rather than, trying to cover something 20 times with the same technology?
I think that's a very interesting question. And because of the diversity of sequencing centers and also the involvement of all of the sequencing companies in this project, then that information will be available. And that's exactly the kind of question that people can ask. If, say, you set a certain goal of accuracy, a certain target of accuracy, and you have a certain budget, then what's the most efficient combination to achieve that?